Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi there, and welcome to the Explaining History podcast. And today I want to talk about a revolutionary moment in world economics that takes place in 1978 to 1979 and creates the framework of the world economy that we live in at the moment. And it's really the birth of what we would describe as neoliberal economics. Obviously, this is a transition that happens globally and begins in several different places, in America, in China. It had already been attempted using dictatorships in South America, particularly Chile. And the decision by America to fully embrace neoliberalism had enormous knock-on effects for Europe and for the Third World. But before we get into that, let's have a little talk about some economic terms here. What do we mean by neoliberalism? Well, it's a term that's bandied about an awful lot these days. Perhaps it it's used to describe far too much. You know, any term that gets overused, democracy, globalization, socialism, turns out to mean very little in the long run. Neoliberalism is quite literally, as you would imagine, new or reinvented economic liberalism. It is an attempt to kind of revive the economic liberalism of the 19th century, which emphasised a small state, the primacy of market forces, and it presented any kind of governmental intervention as an unwanted necessity at best, i.e. in the guise of police forces and armies, and a huge encumbrance and a kind of a vice. At worst, welfare would simply disrupt signals within a labour market, and it would allow people to subsist on a higher level of subsistence than wages would dictate, and therefore would lead to unemployment. That kind of thinking. And this was, in the heyday of the Industrial Revolution, fairly standard classical economic thought. From the late 19th to the mid-20th century, you see in the Western world a rise of social democracy in the guise of things like the Bismarckian social reforms, the liberal social reforms in the run-up to just prior to the First World War, the New Deal, and the post-war social consensus that lasts all the way until the mid to late 1960s, when the unprecedented global boom starts to come unhinged. And the lone voices in the wilderness during this period, I've podcasted about them quite a lot, were the likes of Friedrich Hayek, Ludwig von Mises, There were economists on the economic and political right that equated free markets with free peoples and the heavy hand of the state as they saw it with totalitarianism. And their views were seen as eccentric, marginalised, and they were really not at the acceptable not the acceptable centre ground of economics at all, from the 40s through to really the mid-1970s. And the reason for this is because a mid-century generation of politicians, intellectuals, thinkers, and economists had grown up with an orthodoxy that the state was the only device that could do things like pull countries out of depressions and recessions, that could regulate prices and wages effectively, and that could prevent the instability that had led to two world wars in the 20th century, and that to try to pare back the workings of the state was really kind of economic heresy, and to simply leave countries to the irrational forces of markets again was a nonsense. You find all sorts of writings with people such as Sidney and Beatrice Webb, the Fabian intellectuals, who see market forces as a thing of the past. They would have been, when they were writing in the 20s and 30s, they saw the idea of abandoning an economy simply to ride the waves of market forces as really extremely backward. After all, in this kind of age of modernist thinking, the ability to rationally plan an economy and a society, they both looked to the Soviet Union and admired it immensely. The ability to rationally plan was an entirely modern idea, an entirely kind of progressive and exciting idea. Think of all the things here in the 21st century we imagine we can use science to solve, to control, to govern and to manage. Well, the assumption was in the early 20th century that economies could be managed in roughly the same way. By the 1970s, the idea of state planning, of state control, has gone under something of a kind of a rebrand by the rising economic right, monetarists, who saw their opportunity. And by monetarists, you know, we mean the likes of Hayek and Mises, and obviously their protege, Milton Friedman, who saw the crises of the 1970s, inflation and stagnation, and if you want, check out the previous podcast I've done on this, as a perfect opportunity to finally start to undo the post-war consensus. Hayek had encouraged the development of the think tank, particularly things like the Institute of Economic Affairs, and the as a means of propagating these seemingly unfashionable ideas until they managed to get a hold in mainstream thinking and are a source of great copy for journalists who hold similar sympathies and prejudices. The IEA and the Times had a very profitable partnership throughout the 1970s. So in China, the end of the Cultural Revolution with Mao's death in 1976 and the rise of Deng Xiaoping saw the beginnings of, shall we, what David Harvey calls neoliberalism with Chinese characteristics, the introduction of market forces, and yet the retention of large-scale enterprises in the hands of the state. So there was a curious and characteristically Chinese way of managing the upside of neoliberalism, allowing businesses to compete for profit and competitively, but avoiding sort of neoliberalism's downsides, the unpredictability that and the capriciousness of markets that seem to sweep away industries in the Western world. I'll come on to why in a moment in America and Europe industries were easily swept away. David Harvey, whose book A Brief History of Neoliberalism, he points October 1979 as a key point. With the chairman of the Federal Reserve, Paul Volcker. And Paul Volcker, in Yanis Varoufakis's book, And the Weak Suffer What They Must, which I've mentioned before, Varoufakis points out that Paul Volcker wasn't a neoliberal by instinct. He'd actually been one of the New Dealers. He had been an adherent of the New Deal. But in his view, the economic world order that had sustained Roosevelt's New Deal and sustained Johnson's Great Society had fallen apart. Quite possibly, had they been able to keep this economic world order going, we may never have wound up with neoliberalism. But the reality is that it was not sustainable. What is that world order? Well, the world order is that of America being a surplus nation, i.e. America having large quantities of economic surplus through selling goods and services overseas. This was not possible from the late 1960s onwards because of two main factors. Firstly, European countries had recovered sufficiently that they could now export to America, and America would start to become a deficit nation. And secondly, America's decision to borrow heavily to wage the Vietnam War, which lasted an awful lot longer than the USA had bargained for, plunges America into deficit status by the 1970s. So, a deficit country that can't recycle its currency, and again, if you want some more information on dollar recycling, go to the previous podcast I've done on the stagflation of the 1970s. If you can't recycle your currency because you don't have enough of your own currency, then it becomes very difficult for you to become the linchpin of a new economic order. And as America went from surplus to deficit nation, just as Britain in the First World, after the First World War, had gone from surplus to deficit nation, from being creditor to debtor, in essence, the economic order around it and the economic stability around it, by which America had created this mid-century social democratic moment, this begins to implode. So David Harvey says that the long-standing commitment in the US liberal democratic state to the principles of the New Deal, which meant broadly Keynesian fiscal and monetary policies with full employment as a key objective, was abandoned in favour of a policy designed to quell inflation no matter what the consequences might be for employment. The real rate of interest, which had often been negative during the double-digit inflationary surge of the 1970s, was rendered positive by fiat of the Federal Reserve, so by which it means fiat currency. The nominal rate of interest was raised overnight and, after a few ups and downs, by July 1981, stood at close to 20%. Now, why is that significant? Well, if you put your rate of interest sky high, you will attract finance and destroy business. Why is that? Well, people will want to put their cash in your banks, their investments in your banks, to earn lots and lots of interest. And the businesses who rely on cheap finance will be crippled. Businesses that need to borrow in the short term to pay wages or to invest in their capital stock will be crippled because their loans will be too expensive to pay back. So in a stroke, Volcker, realising that the world of everyone from Roosevelt through to Johnson and after, in fact, that world had been destroyed. That economic system had been destroyed by its own success, ushered in a new system which was designed to reward finance and punish industry. But Yanis Varoufakis points out that the all was not lost for industry. There had to be a way of continuing to make industry profitable despite huge interest rates. And that way was to encourage what we would refer to as flexible employment practices, trying to make the job market, the labour market, more responsive, which means essentially lower wages. If you can push down the wage bill while keeping interest rates high, you still have your attractive profit margins. And that means that people who own capital, who are investors in factories and airports and stations and all the infrastructure of modern capitalism, they continue to do extremely well. At this point, as we emerge into the 1980s, there are fewer and fewer actually family-owned businesses, and the owners of capital aren't the you know, the entrepreneurs that created the great companies of the United States. They're in fact shareholders, and so it was another means of pumping money into Wall Street. So neoliberalism, in this guise, was a way.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
One way of describing it is a way of benefiting finance at the rest of not just industry but much of society. And as wages fall, the gap between wages and the cost of living grows. And this once again can be plugged by financialization, by loans, credit cards, borrowing. And neoliberalism and the development of debt bubbles goes hand in hand. The advent of neoliberalism and the growth in indebtedness that you can essentially plot on a graph. Volcker made a very candid speech at the University of Warwick in 1978, in which he said, "It is tempting to look at the market as an impartial arbiter, but balancing the requirements of a stable international system against the desirability of retaining freedom of action for national policy, a number of countries, including the US, opted for the latter." So this gives us another clue about neoliberalism. Neoliberalism, in part, is synonymous with the tearing up of the Bretton Woods system, the requirements of a stable international system, as Volcker puts it, based on fixed exchange rates and currency values, and therefore a kind of a fairly more equitable sharing out of the world's wealth in the post-war era. The levels of inequality, not just within countries like the US, but obviously between developed and developing nations, dramatically spiraled during the 1980s. And the 1980s is often seen as the lost decade in terms of third world development, and again, largely as a result of changes, economic changes that are made in the first world. As the Bretton Woods system collapsed, Volcker was able to come up with a solution. How do you continue to make a deficit nation, not a surplus nation anymore, how do you continue to make that deficit nation powerful and wealthy? Well, you switch it from being a manufacturing house of things to being a banking house of money. And thus you favour finance at the expense of industry, using interest rates and policies to keep wages down. And in doing so, you become a magnet for all the world's wealth. American workers, for the first time in their history, and this includes the Great Depression, were entering a period of declining wages. There had been no experience like it in the post-war era whatsoever. The golden years, which were seemed to be kind of synonymous with the development of suburbia, growing living standards, you know, multiple car ownership, cheap fuel, and overall rising living standards, actually starts to go into reverse in the 1980s. Then you have this curious irony of America becoming, if anything, more militarily and strategically and diplomatically and economically powerful in the 1980s, yet with a growing population of poor citizens. And neoliberalism, when most faithfully applied, if you examine an indices called the Gini coefficient, which points and shows inequality in societies, seems to be a device for generating poverty in rich countries. The effect on the rest of the world was little short of devastating. Loans made in dollars around the world become vastly more expensive. Countries like in the Eastern Bloc, such as Poland and Romania, learn this. And the manner in which capitalism had managed to penetrate Soviet-dominated countries in the 1970s, which Brezhnev had essentially said, well, you know, if you want to borrow from the West, we don't mind it that much, had led to these catastrophic consequences, and a great deal of the crumbling of the Eastern Bloc can be traced back to this degree of financialization. It has even more significant consequences in countries in Africa and South America that essentially go bankrupt because of the rising cost of dollar loans. And the fact that investment is shifted away very quickly from the third world to the first to take advantage of these super high interest rates. So a great deal of the explosion in third world poverty throughout the 1980s is due to, in no small part, to Volcker's decision. And the transition across the Western world from America to Great Britain to parts of Europe, Canada and Australia, was from manufacturing and industry to finance, and this meant that the difficult demographic in the way of the working class needed to undergo certain adjustments in the eyes of economists. Labour was overvalued, and in the eyes of neoliberals, from the Republicans in America to the Conservatives of Great Britain, overprotected, and due to its overprotected status through union rights, it wielded too much power, and therefore the ability of Labour to collectively bargain needed to be reduced. The consequently, finance sees itself as undervalued and is able to make a strong case to governments around the Western world that it needs its status needs to be enhanced, normally by removing restrictions, red tape, and regulation. And so the regulations, particularly in America, that have been in place since the New Deal, and the rather antiquated traditions of the City of London, combined with various currency controls and other restrictions, are lifted. It leads to stock market deregulation, and in 1986, the City of London's Big Bang, the deregulation of the city, began, and just 12 months later ended in an enormous stock market crash on Black Monday. The irony, really, for the neoliberals is that throughout this period, throughout the period of Reagan and Thatcher, the state doesn't really go into retreat. The size of the state is bigger at the end of the 1980s in Great Britain than it was in 1979. Similarly, despite Ronald Reagan's pronouncements that government is the problem, that it's no longer the solution, the size of government similarly has grown throughout America in the 1980s, particularly the size of the US military. In most countries that have experimented with neoliberalism, the development of markets has not particularly seen a plurality of players in a given market, such as energy or the media. It's seen really the growth of monopoly power, large companies being able, without being regulated, to buy up smaller ones and then form, you know, cartels and conglomerates and that sort of thing, which simply puts unfettered power that may have been wielded by some menacing Stalinist bureaucrat type in the hands of unaccountable and unelected corporate power. However, the culture of neoliberalism that has pervaded Western society and really pervades, you know, globalized world culture via the internet and television and movies and that sort of thing, presents in a kind of an Ayn Randian way the capitalists of the neoliberal era as the sages, as the heroes, as the figures of public virtue, in a way that they would never have been presented during previous epochs of the, you know, social democratic eras, in the post-war years, or even the interwar years, during the 1920s and 30s. So it shows you how neoliberal economics has, in a kind of a hegemonic way, managed to corrupt both politics and culture in the Western world, but also beyond, because you have to remember that neoliberalism has really been the idea of the operating idea in countries like India, China, South America, Chile particularly, and beyond. So from 2008 onwards, we've seen the great fracturing of neoliberalism. It's been plunged into crisis during the world economic crisis in 2008, and seems to have kind of limped on in some zombie format with various bailouts and state subsidies ever since. But the future for the ideology looks particularly bleak, though at the moment there doesn't appear to be any contender waiting in the wings that has sufficient political currency to replace it. Anyway, I hope you found this useful tonight, and I will catch you on the next Explaining History podcast. Thanks very much, all the best, and I'll speak to you soon. Bye-bye.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.